We're in John chapter 11 this morning. Jesus' passage. They've all had this big thing, I am the good shepherd, and this is, I am the resurrection and the life. That's what this chapter is about. The remarkable thing about this text is its absence from the synoptic gospels. I mean, the raising of Lazarus from the dead is huge. I mean, that's a big story. Raising anyone from the dead is pretty significant. Raising Lazarus is a big story, but Matthew, Mark, Luke, absent. Where Matthew surrounds the plot to kill Christ as a rejection of him as king, John describes it here as a response to raising Lazarus. Quite different. Both present the truth, but they focus on events that fit the goals they're trying to convey. Matthew intends more to describe the king and his kingdom, whereas John seeks to have us remain focused on the transformation that comes through Christ. Remember, that's been the theme. If you always stop and think, the transformation that comes through Christ, you see it over and over again in the chapters. Obviously, the transformation brought by Christ in this text is about death to life. That's pretty easy to figure out. That's kind of the most amazing transformation. So let's look at chapter 11, verse 1. Now a certain man was ill, Lazarus of Bethany, the village of Mary and her sister Martha. It was Mary who anointed the Lord with ointment and wiped his feet with her hair, whose brother Lazarus was ill. So the sisters sent to him, saying, Lord, he whom you love is ill. But when Jesus heard it, he said, this illness does not lead to death. It is for the glory of God, so that the Son of God may be glorified through it. Now Jesus loved Martha and her sister and Lazarus. So it starts out, they got this brother who's really sick. They send word to Jesus. They don't specify how they want him to help. It's kind of implied. You know, if you have a friend who can heal people miraculously, you just say, we're sick, and he takes care of it for you, right? They likely knew, though, that it was dangerous for Jesus to come back to where they were. Bethany, where they're at, is only a very short distance from Jerusalem. And Jesus, at the end of our last chapter, again, his life is in danger and he has to leave the area. So they probably knew it was dangerous for him to come back. They also, though, may have known about Jesus' ability to heal from a distance. And maybe they had that in mind too. So, verse 6, when he had heard that Lazarus was ill, he stayed 2 days longer in the place where he was. Now, a typical response, somebody's ill, oh, we'll hang around a little longer. Then after this, he said to his disciples, let's go to Judea again. The disciples said to him, Rabbi, the Jews were just now seeking to stone you, and you're going there again? Jesus answered, are there not 12 hours in the day? If anyone walks in the day, he does not stumble, because he sees the light of this world. But if anyone walks in the night, he stumbles, because the light is not in him. So Jesus waits 2 days before he begins his journey to Mary and Martha. Lazarus, though, is probably already dead before Jesus gets the message that he's sick. Because Jesus is at least a day's walk away from where they are. So they send the messengers out. That's a day. Then you got 2 days of waiting, 2 days of Mary and Martha doing this. And then you have another day for Jesus to come back, which is a total of 4 days. 4 days. Important number, 4 days. We know that Lazarus, when they get there, is going to have been dead for 4 days. So Jesus loses nothing time-wise by waiting 2 days. He knows also here that he knows the outcome from the beginning. He knows exactly what's going to happen, that Lazarus' illness is not going to end in death. He knows that death is not the end here. He knows that whatever happens through this, God will be glorified. And his delay in coming and healing had nothing to do, we also know, with whether he loved them or not. Look at that verse. It says there in verse 5, now Jesus loved Martha and her sister and Lazarus. He loved them, and he waits 2 more days. He loves them, and he didn't heal Lazarus. This is a common error we make with God. When it looks like he's waiting, you know, God, what are you waiting for? Here, I've made the prayer request. We're on this time schedule here, right? You know, we have to sometimes tell him a few times about this time schedule. And it looks like what? He's delaying, like he's waiting. It has nothing to do with the love of God. Whatever the delay is, has nothing to do with his love. It's no question. We question whether he loves us if there's a delay, but he doesn't. Jesus waited 2 more days because, why? he's moved by the will of the Father, not by the will of people. That's never going to change. Whenever you pray to God, it's the will of the people. I mean, you're asking him for something. Jesus responds to the will of the Father, not the will of people. So he waits two more days till the time is right for the Father's timing. When the disciples, then, when he says, we're going there, the disciples say, do you remember why we're not there right now? The danger, they replied to him about the danger of traveling. Jesus said, in essence, you know, this thing, oh, you got to walk in the light while there's light. What does he mean by all that? He's essentially saying this, my hour is not yet come. We've seen that several times in this book. Nothing can happen to him because his hour hasn't yet come. He's able to go back into this very dangerous situation because he is the light of the world. His hour is not yet come. There's no danger for him right now to go. He will be safe. It's not his time to depart from the earth, so he's safe to travel there. And they will be safe if they go with him. Verse 11. After saying these things, he said to him, our friend Lazarus has fallen asleep, but I go to awaken him. The disciples said to him, Lord, if he's fallen asleep, he'll recover. You know, when the fever breaks, you're not tired anymore, right? Now, Jesus had spoken of his death, but they thought that he meant taking a rest and sleep. Then Jesus told them plainly, Lazarus has died, and for your sake I am glad that I was not there, so that you may believe. But let us go to him. So Thomas, called the twin, said to his fellow disciples, let us also go, that we may die with him. Great, Thomas. I love Thomas. Thomas is the greatest guy in these words. So anyway, Jesus tells his disciples very plainly, Lazarus is dead. And Jesus, though, he describes death as what? Sleep. Just a sleep. For the believer, that's as bad as death will ever be. Just sleep. It's just as bad as it can be. Death does not strike forever, and death does not need to be feared because of Christ. Now, the disciples assume that Jesus is talking about literal sleep rather than death. And that's kind of convenient in terms of traveling to Judea. He's just sleeping. Okay, he's fine. We don't really have to go there. And then Jesus has to break the news to them. But what I find interesting here is Jesus ties this sad news, he's died, and then he ties it to gladness. Read that verse again. Look at it, verse 14 and 15. Jesus told them, Lazarus has died, and for your sake I'm glad. You're like, what? That is so wrong. We don't associate death with gladness. But Jesus does. He also ties it to one other thing, to faith. To faith. I'm glad that I wasn't there so that you may believe. Now, anyone hearing the story for the first time should feel the same shock that the disciples had at these words. Lazarus is dead, and I'm glad. And sometimes I just imagine disciples' mouths falling open. Who is this guy? He says the craziest things sometimes to us. So the same shock that they had, you should have the first time you hear the story. How can Jesus rejoice at the death of his friend? And what does it have to do with faith? So Thomas, he knows how to respond. Some people say, you know, usually it's Peter. You know, usually it's Peter there with his mouth open and his shoe ready to go in it. But some hypothesize that the reason this isn't found in Matthew and Mark is because Peter wasn't there. So Peter's not even present. So it's Thomas's turn. It's like, Peter's not here. It's my turn to say something. So he does. And he says, let's go with Jesus into danger so we can die with him there. And these words, they show courage. I mean, he's so courageous. He anticipates they will be captured and stoned to death. And he's got strength. But they also show a lack of faith of how things are going to work out. So on the one hand, you got this lack of faith that, okay, Jesus is going to meet his end and we're going to meet it with him. But also courageous. He's willing to die for Jesus in this moment. Following Christ's path of sacrificial love, even unto death, is the disciple's path. And that's what he's willing to do. That's what he's willing to do. Right here, he's taking up his cross to follow Jesus. We can't even say that we're his disciples if we're unwilling to follow him to death. So Thomas, in this moment, shows a great willingness to follow Jesus, even though he doesn't fully know what it means here. Verse 17. Now when Jesus came, he found that Lazarus had already been in the tomb 4 days. Bethany was near Jerusalem, about 2 miles off, and many of the Jews had come to Martha and Mary to console them concerning their brother. So Jesus arrives at Bethany. It's 2 miles away from Jerusalem. It's not very far. Very, very dangerous position to be in. He's right in the backyard of those who wanted to kill him. Lazarus has been dead for 4 days. All right, remember? Day for the messenger, 2 days waiting. and a day to come back. 4 days. So some superstitious people believe that the soul hung around the body, checking it out, up to 3 days. And then on the fourth day, when it saw that decomposition was setting in, the soul would say, I'm not going back there, and would leave. And that's why 4 days is very important here. I really don't know what the soul actually said. I just want to clarify that for you. Anyway, the point of the matter is the 4 days indicates decay has set in. Many Jews from Jerusalem had come to comfort Martha and Mary. And the important thing here is John uses the word Jews. And he uses this word, it's very significant, because all through his gospel, Jews typically indicates those in opposition to Jesus. So some of the people here, it's part of the crowd, but some in the crowd are hostile to Jesus, and that's important in this story. Verse 20. So when Martha heard that Jesus was coming, she went and met him, but Mary remained seated in the house. Martha said to Jesus, Lord, if you had been here, my brother would not have died. But even now I know that whatever you ask from God, God will give you. It sounds like she's got great faith, but she doesn't. Jesus said to her, your brother will rise again. This is this confidence. You know, even at a Christian funeral, we don't, you know, this isn't the end. So Jesus says these words to her. Martha said to him, I know that he will rise again in the resurrection on the last day. And Jesus said to her, I am the resurrection and the life. Whoever believes in me, though he die, yet shall he live. And everyone who lives and believes in me shall never die. Do you believe this? She said to him, yes, Lord, I believe that you are the Christ, the Son of God, who is coming into the world. And in that statement, she has great faith. So Martha, she comes out to speak to Jesus. Jesus doesn't get right to the house, and I think it's because of this crowd of people. She expresses faith in Jesus' power to have kept Lazarus alive. And she has faith that God would listen to Jesus no matter what he asked now. But she says it with no hint of time. You know, there's no hint to even Jesus' response, he will rise again. There's no hint of time in that either. It seems like she's a little disappointed that Jesus waited those 2 extra days. You know, she sent the messenger. If Jesus would have hurried, it would have said something. But the fact that he took so long, what does that mean? Unfortunately, we can't make much of her faith in saying that God would listen to whatever he asked because of what's coming later in the story. Jesus responds to her by promising that Lazarus would rise again, but gives no hint to the time. And Martha counters by saying she doesn't doubt the resurrection. It's a future resurrection, but she says that's a long way from now. It's a long time off. And that's how we feel in this life. You know, death, yeah, Christ is victor over the grave, but still feels like it's such a long time off. And Jesus then gives these phenomenal words, I am the resurrection and the life. Believing in him provides eternal life even if death comes. Because when a person enters into a trusting relationship with Jesus, it's a lasting relationship. It doesn't end with our death. Relationships, Christian relationships, do not end in death. So Jesus makes it last forever. Death never breaks relationship with God. However, it takes trust in him. So I guess Martha shows that it takes more faith. I was trying to think, you know, looking at her, because she's in a situation most of us, I'm figuring, have never been in, right? And probably never will be. Have you ever seen somebody resurrected in this life? No. And I venture to say you will never experience that. You might, but you probably won't. So I had to look at Martha, and I look at her situation. She's in one where she has a dead brother who is going to be raised from the dead, and Jesus is kind of hinting at it, but she also believes in a God who raises the dead as a future event. And I guess Martha shows us that it takes more faith that Jesus can raise a person 4 days in the tomb, bringing him back to life, than to believe in an afterlife, right? A future resurrection. You know, in one sense, we have this idea that a future resurrection, yeah, God will raise everybody at the last day and go to heaven. We believe in that. But it seems like it takes less faith to believe in that than to believe that if somebody was dead right here, someone else in the room is going to raise them from the dead. It's easier, in other words, to believe in a God who raises the dead at some unseen future time than to believe that he will raise a body now before us. Martha believes Jesus' words. She believes that he's the Christ, the Messiah. She believes he's the Son of God. I mean, that was the big issue in the last chapter. She believes that he was sent by God to do the will of God as he came to the world. But that faith is going to be tested very shortly. Then Mary and Jesus, verse 28. When she had said this, she went and called her sister Mary, saying in private, "The teacher is here and is calling for you." Obviously, there's parts of the conversation that are left out. And when she heard it, she rose quickly and went to him. Now Jesus had not yet come into the village, but was still in the place where Martha had met him. When the Jews, who were with her at the house, consoling her, saw Mary rise quickly and go out, they followed her, supposing that she was going to the tomb to weep there. Now when Mary came out to where Jesus was and saw him, she fell at his feet, saying to him, "Lord, if you had been here, my brother would not have died." I mean, virtually exactly the same words as her sister. I imagine in 4 days, they had lots of time to have that same conversation over. If only Jesus had been here. So Martha, done with Mary. Mary comes out. She remains at the house at first. Martha had gone out. Seems Martha discreetly tells Mary to come out. And she goes out there and the crowd follows. She doesn't have the same discussion, though, that Martha has. And often, when you're talking about Martha, you're saying, "Oh yeah, Martha was the one who was doing the dishes and cooking the food, and Mary sat at his feet." And here we have kind of it flipped around, where Martha is this one having faith and going to Jesus and having this statement about Jesus being the Christ that, you know, rivals Peter's in the book of Matthew. And then Lazarus is going to be raised from the dead. No matter what levels of faith in Jesus have been expressed at this point by Mary or Martha or any of the disciples, no one really expects him to raise Lazarus from the dead. This is the big shock in the story. Verse 33. When Jesus saw her weeping, and the Jews who had come with her also weeping, there'd be natural weeping, and then there was also performance weeping, you know, the wailing that you see. He was deeply moved in his spirit and greatly troubled. And he said, "Where have you laid him?" And they said to him, "Lord, come and see." Jesus wept. So the Jews said, "See how he loved him." But some of them said, "Could not he who opened the eyes of the blind man also have kept this man from dying?" The crowd is questioning this too. But right here we see Jesus deeply moved. The word that's used there for this first thing, the deeply moved in his spirit, it's kind of like an expression that you make. And it's tied sometimes in some context to an anger. And some people look at Jesus' anger here and they'll interpret he was angry at death, he was angry at the crowd, angry at unbelief, whatever it is. I don't think it has anything to do with that at all. I think it's just emotion. Because it's the word comes from the idea of the snorting like a horse. That's where that word comes from. And you know when somebody's deeply emotional and they're crying and they're trying to get a breath and they make that sound, the sound you've probably all made when your chest is heaving, I think that's the sound being described here. I don't think it's anger at all. We know what it's like when our bodies feel that deep anguish and sadness. And then Jesus is weeping here. And there's various theories as to why he's weeping. You know, I think it's pretty simple. He sees everybody else being sad. And when you see somebody sad and crying, it makes you cry too. Even when you see somebody happy and crying, it can make you cry. We respond to emotions that way. It's normal. It's natural. And I think that's what Jesus is seeing, feeling. He sees what they have, and it's producing a strong emotion in him just as he sees it in other people. I mean, we watch movies and we cry, and we know it's not real, right? You can imagine seeing these people that he loves, Mary and Martha, and they're completely heartbroken over this loss. So much more so in real life, when somebody hurts, we feel that. And I think that's the point here. I think that's what John wants us to understand, that Jesus knows the pain that people experience in the worst times of life. He doesn't just walk into it, "Well, I got this all figured out anyway," completely calm and emotionless. He walks into it and he sees the anguish of soul that people are experiencing, and he knows it and he feels it. And I think John wants us to know this about Jesus. He's deeply moved. God is deeply moved by human suffering. He cares about it. Even though he knows what he's about to do, it doesn't diminish his response to the pain that he sees people having. And there's another part too, I think. You know, this is the human side of Jesus. He knows. The Father tells him what's going on, right? I think ahead of time, you know, he knows that Lazarus is dying. I think he knew that. I think he knew that before the messengers got there. Because he's responding not to the will of people, but to the will of God. And I can just imagine him. He knows Lazarus is dying. He knows he just has to say the word and he will be healed. And the Father's will is no. You can't do that. So in the midst of all this pain, all these people hurting, all this pain has come, it never needed to happen. He could have healed at a distance. And all this pain and suffering and sadness never would have happened. And he knows that. And he wasn't allowed to do anything about it. Because it wasn't the plan of God. Verse 38. Then Jesus, deeply moved again, came to the tomb. It was a cave and a stone lay against it. Jesus said, "Take away the stone." Martha, the sister of the dead man, said to him, "Lord, by this time there will be an odor, for he has been dead 4 days." Jesus said to her, "Did I not tell you that if you believed, you would see the glory of God?" So they took away the stone, and Jesus lifted up his eyes and said, "Father, I thank you that you have heard me. I knew that you always hear me, but I said this on account of the people standing around, that they may believe that you sent me." When he had said these things, he cried out with a loud voice, "Lazarus, come out!" The man who had died came out, his hands and feet bound with linen strips, and his face wrapped with a cloth. Jesus said to him, "Unbind him and let him go." You know, at Jesus' command to remove the stone, Martha, protesting, she's very practical here. It's not going to be a pretty sight. It's going to smell bad. And Jesus prompts her one more time, "Believe, just believe." But look at his words. She has to believe. Why? Because if she doesn't believe, what will she miss? The glory of God. She will miss the glory of God if she doesn't believe. It's going to be a remarkable test of faith to remove that stone. All present, everybody there, will see Lazarus be raised from the dead. Every one of them will see the same thing. But only those with faith would know the source and be able to glorify God. Only those ones. Without faith, you can't give God the glory for what you see. Those who saw without faith will turn against Christ. They'll see the same miracle, but turn against him because they don't have faith. Then Jesus, his prayer is interesting. You know, it's not your typical, "Oh, Father, please raise Lazarus from the dead," that you would expect. It's not like that at all. Look what he says. Jesus prays to the Father for the sake of everybody else to hear. It's not so much a prayer to the Father as much as a prayer so everybody gets to hear it. That's kind of what praying out loud is about. But anyway, that's the point here. Jesus prays to the Father so that the people around him will know that in hearing him, in hearing Jesus, the Father acts. That's Jesus is the mover of the Father, not people. He offers this word aloud that the crowds may believe that he was sent. Look at his words. "Father, I thank you that you have heard me. I knew that you always hear me. But I said this on account of the people standing around, that they may believe that you sent me." See, this is all about for the crowds to recognize that God has sent Christ. God's already answered his prayer. I remember, you know, I imagine that it was back before the messengers came, and it was in that discussion, Lazarus has died, or he's dying. Should we heal him? And the Father says, no. And the Son says, later? And they work out this timing thing. Then Jesus commands Lazarus to come out of the tomb. He just comes right out. He's still bound. I don't know if they had wrapped his legs individually or if he's hopping. We don't know. And he tells those around him to untie him, and he's free of his grave clothes. But then we see the response of the people. Verse 45, "Many of the Jews, therefore, who had come with Mary and had seen what he did, believed in him." That's the response of a lot of them. They just saw. I mean, how could you not believe that? They're convinced by what they saw. It's no small thing. It was a big deal. But then there were those who saw and did not believe. Verse 46, "But some of them went to the Pharisees and told them what Jesus had done. So the chief priests and the Pharisees gathered the council and said, 'What are we to do? For this man performs many signs.'" This is a big sign, you know, nothing like what they had done before. "If we let him go on like this, everyone will believe in him, you think? And the Romans will come and take away both our place and our nation." So these people, they go to the Pharisees. You know, there was probably like posters around, you know, wanted Jesus. If you see this guy, report him. The Pharisees got together with some Sadducees. And their opposition to Jesus through his ministry, it often comes from the Pharisees. If you look at the book, the life of Jesus, it's always, and Jesus argued with the Pharisees over this. But at the end, it's the Sadducees that really are the ones who bring the death of Christ. They fear, and here it is, that Jesus will continue to gain a following. They fear that that following, the messianic idea that this is the Christ, the King, will result in Roman intervention. That's what scares them to death. They know that if they rebel against Rome, or somebody in the community rebels against Rome, the Romans will come in and attack them. We know historically that is exactly what happened. And that's what they're afraid of. The Romans didn't want the Jews stirred up, and the Sadducees, the ones who ran the temple, they didn't want the temple and their worship all disrupted. It was a good income. It was good control. It allowed them to be the Jewish people that they were. They had good political positions. All that would be interfered with if somebody comes along and claims to be the Messiah. The status quo was good enough for them. Messianic fervor would only jeopardize that stability. So they seek here to kill the true king because they like their earthly kingdom just the way it was. Thank you very much. After all, the Sadducees didn't believe in a Davidic Messiah at all. And they certainly didn't believe in a God who raised the dead. Then Caiaphas, the high priest, says this, verse 49. But one of them, Caiaphas, who was high priest that year, said to them, "You know nothing at all." You know, this is a guy, he's arrogant, he's rude, he has a good position of power, and he's mean. "You know nothing at all, nor do you understand that it's better for you that one man should die for the people, not that the whole nation should perish." He did not say this on his own accord, but being high priest that year, he prophesied that Jesus would die for the nation, and not for the nation only, but also to gather into one the children of God who were scattered abroad. So from that day on, they made plans to put him to death. So Caiaphas speaks prophetically. He doesn't even know he's doing it. He's speaking in a bad way. You know, think about your sense of justice. The idea of, how about if somebody was going to come here and kill us all, we just picked somebody like Alan and said, "Kill him instead. He's done nothing wrong, but it's better if he dies and the rest of us go free." Y'all in favor? That's a good idea? What do you think, Alan? No? Sorry. Anyway, that's what Caiaphas is doing. He's volunteering somebody to be killed because it's good for everybody. It doesn't matter if the guy's guilty or not or whatever. It's not going to affect him in any way. That's the kind of guy Caiaphas is. Don't you want rulers like that, right? He thinks it's better for Jesus to be put to death as a protection against the Jews' earthly kingdom. If we kill this guy, it will let us keep our kingdom the way it is. But God intends his words, Caiaphas' words and actions, to speak of Jesus' sacrificial death for the people. The flip side of all this, of course, is that the rejection of Jesus by the Jews ultimately is the beginning of the end of them as a nation. This is the end. The moment they reject their king is the beginning of the end of everything. It brings God's judgment in. The rejection of him leads to their judgment and rejection by God. John sees the work of Christ's death as one that gathers together what has been scattered. The Jews that were scattered. Why? Because of God's judgment. So Jesus' death is a restoration of those who have been already scattered by judgment, not to mention those who will further be scattered when God judges the death of Christ. But John also has in mind here the Gentiles who would come to Christ as well. Sin brings judgment and divides and scatters people. That's what the sin of Caiaphas, the sin of the other Jews, does. But the death of Christ brings forgiveness and reconciliation. It restores people to God and to one another. Then John ends this section by telling us that Jesus withdraws from them until the Passover, verse 54. Jesus therefore no longer walked openly among the Jews, but went from there to the region near the wilderness to a town called Ephraim, and there he stayed with his disciples. He's right on the edge of the wilderness now, so if anybody comes for him, he can go off into it. Now the Passover of the Jews was at hand, and many went up from the country to Jerusalem before the Passover to purify themselves. They were looking for Jesus and saying to one another as they stood in the temple, "What do you think? That he will not come to the feast at all?" Now the chief priests and the Pharisees had given orders that if anyone knew where he was, he should let them know so they might arrest him. So it's all building up to this last final feast. We know that John has taught all these feasts. Meanwhile, plans are being made to murder Jesus. Jerusalem began to be filled with pilgrims. They're all coming in from all over the place for this feast, and the religious leaders are keeping an eye out in the crowd so they can find Jesus. Jesus knew the danger, and they knew he knew it. And so they begin to wonder whether he's going to come to the feast that celebrates freedom and deliverance by substitutionary death. The raising of Lazarus gives the disciples a whole new depth to their faith, right? It just changes everything. They see firsthand that Jesus is able to raise the dead. They already believed in a God who raised the dead. That's something they already had. And now they see that power working through Jesus. This sign is preparatory to Jesus' own resurrection. However, it's one thing to be alive and raise another person from the dead. It's a whole other thing to be dead and raise yourself from the dead. That's where we leave here, getting down to the final days of Jesus' life. Let's pray. Lord, we thank you for your life. You came to bring life to us, resurrection life, to resurrect the relationship we now have with God the Father, bringing new life to it in this life, a life and relationship that will never end through all eternity. In Jesus' name, amen.